Accession number 31408.
John Shoebridge, reel 6.
Right. This course was good fun, really. We flew about 8 or 9 or 10 different airplanes, or more than that, probably. All the big American ones, the Grummans, the Grumman Avengers, the Wildcats, the Hellcats, the Dauntless, all the famous wartime naval planes. Never dreamt we'd fly before.
These were all single-engine?
Oh, all single-engine jobs, oh, yes. I flew the Spitfires and the Hurricanes, which, again, we never thought we would have flown.
And where were you? Sorry.
This is the naval air station at Worthy Down. This is near Winchester. Barracudas, lots of different sorts on make-believe test flights. Test flight, which is another subject, or maintenance test flight, is a different thing to an experimental test pilot, as you will understand. But you are testing proven aircraft, usually modified for naval purposes, or coming back after general repairs or something to make sure they're okay. A test flight has a standard routine, which we were taught there. You have a knee pad, you write it all down on, come back, we report, and sometimes it's up to you to say you want another flight to correct something, or it's okay the first go, or sometimes they go on 2 or 3, 4 flights.
What, I mean, very briefly, what was the test flight routine? What was the checklist? I mean,
now off we go then.
Okay, what you did on a test.
This is reading at the moment. Yeah. The maintenance test pilot's course, as previously mentioned, lasted 2 months and was most thorough. It covered all aspects of the aircraft, engine controls, flying controls, etc. And a detailed report had to be compiled during an initial test lasting some 30 to 40 minutes. This report was accomplished during flight using a knee pad. Sometimes a second flight was necessary should a particular fault have emerged.
I'm just thinking of the different sorts of aircraft you flew. And this is at the train. This is where you were training to be a test pilot, wasn't it?
Yep.
We're running, yes, okay.
I mentioned all the different aircraft I've flown here.
Yeah, you said that in the tape before, that's fine.
And that's all here, you see.
I'm just trying to think of, in general, your impressions of different ones, some that must have been difficult, some that were easy. I mean, the Spitfire, I've already said it was an absolute joy to fly. And
well, yeah.
Especially after your experience with the Swordfish, which wasn't exactly a speedy plane. And
well,
I mean,
we were.
Do you remember?
Can you stop that for a moment?
I can, certainly, yeah. You were just testing them after sort of major overhaul. So you did this testing training for 2 months, which was from June.
That was a course.
A course.
July and August, you could fairly say.
July and August. This wasn't before the Mammoth leave, where you were forgotten about by the...
This was after the Mammoth leave, oh, yes.
Well, we haven't talked about the story of that, too. That's quite
interesting. Well, there's not much story about that, really. I can tell you about it. All right, shall we do the Mammoth leave, then?
Well, it's just a curious...
Okay, well, when the war ended...
This is May.
We aren't up to the Mammoth leave now. No, we're not up. You're quite right now. We are now in July 45, and I finished the maintenance test pilot's course in around about mid-September 45. I then went on to a 2-week dual twin engine course, which took place at Dale near Pembrokeshire in Wales, on the Airspeed Oxfords. That was a 2-week course to teach me how to fly twin-engine airplanes. Now, we then were sent on leave for what we imagined was going to be 2 or 3 weeks before being posted to a test pilot's job in some air station. In practice, this leave went on for 19 weeks, despite pleas from both myself and my good friend Ron Clayton, who was on the same leave as I was, to be posted somewhere. But, however, we weren't posted anywhere until round about May 1946, possibly April, when I was sent, as was Ron Clayton, to Naval Air Station Ford, near Littlehampton in Sussex, to convert to Mosquitoes. Now, this was a great excitement, because, as you will know, the Mosquito was the most famous wartime aeroplane. And, of course, Yes, on April 1st, I see, I flew my first mosquito.
So for just that period of time, that 19 weeks, you were just kicking your heels?
We were going up to London and enjoying ourselves. I went down to Torquay, where Ron lived with his parents, and we played a lot of golf. All golf courses in those days, and during the war, after the war, were available to serving officers and services for 1 shilling a round. So we played in the most exclusive golf courses for as little as a shilling. There was one splendid course near Woking, New Zealand golf clubs, only open to members living 20 miles out of Woking. We played a lot on that one. Anyway, well, that's what we did, really. We just had a great big jolly. Our pay we used to take to the bank every month. The Red Lion was the local pub in Horsell where I lived. There was a lot of time spent in that. Eventually, anyway, I got sent to a mosquito training course in Ford.
One thing I wanted, at the end, you were presumably offered the option to take up a permanent commission.
Yes, I'd forgotten that, but yes, at the end of the war, we were offered the chance to take up a permanent commission. No, sorry, a 4-year short service commission, actually, which I accepted. So in September 45, I was transferred to a straight wing from a wavy wing and was on a 4-year short service commission. Yep.
You had no hesitation about it. You wanted to do this.
Wanted to do that. Indeed, I did, yes.
Because?
Well, I just liked the service life, and I was hoping maybe at some time in the future I could be transferred to a permanent commission. And also, at that time, 4 years is a lifetime, isn't it, really?
You were what?
I would have been 23 then. Just on 23 then, yeah, when it happened, yeah.
So you go and finally, and you go and start flying mosquitoes.
Mosquitoes, April the 1st was my first one, at Ford. A short course there, only it's just a month, actually. I see I was passed down as high average. Well, that was good, wasn't it?
How did you find the mosquito then?
A most beautiful aeroplane. It really was a most beautiful aeroplane. It really was. A delight to fly. Very fast, and obviously after Swordfish, and even after the test pilot's course, it was quite a handful, but we did only a couple of hours, 3 hours dual control, dual on it, and then we made solo. The naval mosquito, we were flying RAF mosquitoes on the training, but the naval ones were, strangely enough, better than the RAF ones. And that's most unusual, because normally any naval aircraft is far worse, mostly because of the heavy gear required for landing on the decks and things, but the mosquitoes had to have small undercarriages to land on decks, and therefore the weight of this undercarriage was vastly less, particularly when the undercarriage was down, of course, and not much slipstream. In many ways, it was a better aircraft. In practice, mosquitoes never flew in squadrons from aircraft carriers, though they did land on.
Did you ever land one on?
No, I didn't. No. But it was a lovely aeroplane. And my second or third flight from Ford had an amusing experience, in the sense that I took off, and Tangmere, the big RAF air station, is only about 4 miles away from Ford. And being new on the mosquito, I did quite a big circuit and landed. And the airplane looked a little strange, and it turned out, I thought, hell, I'm on the wrong airfield. So I rapidly taxied right round, and despite red lights flashing in all directions, I took off again and phoned Ford. And in the meantime, apparently, Tangmere had rung up Ford control house and said, if you're looking for mosquito number so-and-so, it's just landed here. However, I got into our circuit and landed again, and nothing more was said as far as I remember. So that was a mosquito course, and then I got a short leave and then a splendid posting to Royal Naval Air Station Culham, which is only 8 miles from Oxford, on the Oxford Abingdon Road, in a beautiful area. Lovely golf course we all made members of. Whereas Ron Creighton, my pal, he said it was great stuff, but he got sent up to near Warrington, the sort of a horrible, dirty, smelly old industrial area up there, to Royal Naval Air Station Stretton, where he was flying a lot of old, battered old things. But should you by any chance interview Ron, he will probably tell you that Stretton was a much nicer place than Culham. But I tell him, if you do say to him, tell him I disagree with him.
And what were you flying there?
We flew. No, this was the beauty of Culham, as against Stretton. because they used to have flied battered old things, all being repaired. Now, we all flew brand new aeroplanes, straight from the factories, are coming in to be modified to naval requirements, mostly radar and electrical stuff. And they were Fireflies, Sea Mosquitoes, the later on the Sea Hornets, which was, as you probably know, the fastest piston-engine aircraft in the world. That's the development of the Mosquito. Sea Furies and Sea Fires. And all these aeroplanes are brand new.
So they were still making Sea Fires after the war?
Oh, yes. Well, I mean, this was... These things were a joy to fly. They were spotlessly clean and not an inch of paint missing and everything. Great. Just modified up.
And are there any ones that sort of stick in your... I mean, we can't talk about every one, but are there any ones which stick in your mind as being especially wonderful to fly or especially bad? Or
the most lovely one to fly, of course, was the Mosquito. And that was a glorious airplane to fly. Sea Fires were great, but though they're a little bit heavier than the Spitfires, I believe, actually, but they were great. But I wasn't a fighter pilot, really, you see, and really they were very, very light on the controls, very light. Firefly was a good, steady old warhorse. And the Sea Fury later on, of course, that was a very high-powered, single-engined fighter, very high-powered aircraft. And it was a lovely, lovely 2 years I had there. Great golf, great cricket, played all the Oxford colleges, both at rugby and cricket. Great pubs, lovely life, 2 wardrooms. Nothing to do with flying, by the way, but our most amusing experience, we had 2 wardrooms, about a mile apart. I was in the junior one, it was rather nice when you had a lieutenant commander in charge of us as against the commander and the other one, a bit stuffy, all the senior officers in the other one. But we used to go up to the other one, the main wardroom, occasionally in the evening, have a few drinks, if we weren't going ashore. And on the way back, it was bucketing with rain. I had a motorbike with a sidecar for my parachutes to motor around the airfield during my test flying days. And there was a chief PO walking back in the pouring rain, so I stopped like a lift back. Yes, thank you, sir, very much indeed. So in he gets. So on the way back, as you may know, motorbikes, I turned into our place and go quite slowly, turn the wheel. Now, as you may know, if you go the wrong way, motorbikes turn right up, and this one duly went right up and deposited the chief PO in a great big puddle. Now, I was a young lieutenant then, and I never forget, he got this about 11 o'clock at night in the pitch darkness. He gets out, stands to attention, salutes, and said, "You bloody fool, sir." Sorry, you never forget these stories, do you, really?
What sort of motorbike was it?
It was a pretty standard one.
BSA, probably.
Quite a well-known make it was, indeed it was, yeah. And then I did the 2 years test flying from Cullen, which was great fun, really.
Anything vivid that sticks in your mind?
Well, we had one or two things. Quite a number of things actually happened, but...
For example?
I'm trying to think of anything very special.
It doesn't matter, but I mean, just...
I can remember what we did have... I had only one real crash. That was in a Mosquito, funny enough. That was an RAF Mosquito, which had landed at Cullen due to some fault or another. I don't know what it was, but been repaired. Nothing very serious, as far as I was aware. The ferry flight would have taken on to somewhere else, and they requested it be tested over before they went any more. So I duly tested it. And Cullen had very short runways. This was one of the shorter ones. Only had 3, but this was one of the shorter 2. And halfway down the runway, and too late to stop, I realised the throttles would only open 3/4 of the way. But I had no choice but to go on and hope I could get airborne, which I did. Not by a lot, but I got airborne and left the undercarriage and flaps down and turned round on the downwind leg, bellowing out for an emergency landing. And coming in, all went well and came in over normal speed and everything else, over the hedge and touched down on the runway. And a little bit too late, I realised the throttles were only closed about 3/4 closed. And I then switched off the magnetos to close the engines down completely, because it was too late by then. So we went along steadily, steady pace, me braking as hard as I could, within reason, of course, over the end of the runway, through the grass, through a big stone hedge at the end of the airfield, across the main Abingdon-Oxford Road, because in those days there weren't many cars about, so... and luckily there wasn't any car there, through the next hedge into a farmer's field where the undercarriage collapsed, and I came to rest with one engine smoking and me using the emergency exit to get out of the cockpit, which I did, shortly followed by the ambulance arriving and the crash tender and all that, fire engines. Anyway, they taken up to sick bay and given two large brandies, and the PMO, Commander PMO, said, we'll meet you in the wardroom at midday, more brandies, and sent to bed that afternoon and flying again the next morning.
And no blame attached?
No, it wasn't my fault at all, no. If they turned out to be, I believe there were some rubber fibres or something in between the throttle linkage systems were missing, and you got a metal-to-metal contact, and these things had just jammed, both on the takeoff, and then again they jammed after I landed. It was unfortunate, but it's one of those things, really.
And the plane was a write-off, of course.
I would think so, yeah. Another one happened on another Mosquito when all the flying control instruments failed. Well, it was the airspeed indicator, rate of climb and the altimeter, so I had no idea how high I was and no idea of my airspeed. And it was a bit dodgy, that. And Mosquitoes were such lovely airplanes. They gave you no warning of a stall at all. So coming into land, you know, you could suddenly stall and you wouldn't realise you'd stall till it was too late. So I got a Wren with me, a Wren radar operator, because they used to chest-test the radars. Got her to strap herself in thoroughly, and me too, and made what I hoped was looking at the ground, judging at how fast I was going, really. And we did manage to stop. The people in the control tower said they saw the smoke pouring from my tyres as I was braking, frightened the tyre was going to burst, but which it didn't. And we managed to stop on the grass verge about 20 yards short of a hedge followed by the River Thames, because the Thames ran right round the edge of the airfield, but except for the Abingdon Road bit. That was another one I remember. We had lots of little ones happen, but nothing of any huge moment, though, really. They were mostly small stuff connected with the radar and things like that.
Because, I mean, there was now a big technological leap forward, wasn't there? Jets were beginning to come in.
Well, not quite then, you know.
A couple of years later, I think.
But Cullen was a great... I enjoyed Cullen very much indeed, I didn't, yeah.
In terms of what was generally happening in Europe and, of course, Asia, but now... I mean, when the atomic bomb went off, do you remember that occasion?
Yes, I do. I must have...
August 45.
Yeah, oh, yes, oh, Lord, yes. I was at Worthy Down then, I think. Yeah, on the test pilot's course then, yeah. Oh, yeah, I remember that, yeah.
How do you remember hearing about it?
On the radio, I think.
And it was clear what it was?
No, not at all. Oh, yeah, absolutely. And the second one at Nagasaki as well. Oh, yes, indeed. But I think the only thing we were surprised the Japanese hadn't surrendered straight away, really. Oh, yes, yeah, we knew about that.
And so if we again go back to when you were test flying... which would be, I suppose, in
46, 47, and the first bit of 48, yeah.
And the way that Europe was slowly, the Marshall Plan, I mean, were you conscious of this? Did you make any trips to mainland Europe?
No. Well, we did, yeah, no, I didn't, not until the early 50s, or maybe late 40s did I make a trip to Europe, when we went to Paris and Nice, then, yeah.
Okay. So... anything else that sticks in your mind about that period of test pilot flying?
We could go on, you know, for...
Well, I mean, only if there's something that's...
Two or three hours, but I'll definitely have a look.
That sort of you think would be worth mentioning. It's difficult to do this.
I don't think so. Maybe I could finish on a personal note about Cullen in general.
Do.
Just a short personal note from here.
Sure.
One very happy couple of years I did spend at Cullen, set as it was, surrounded by the River Thames, with an easy reach of the lovely city of Oxford, and its living accommodation amid woods and parkland flowers. Five-hole golf course was built adjacent to the wardrooms. Very friendly, peacetime feeling. First wardroom mess dinner was at Cullen. Station cricket and rugby teams played matches against various Oxford colleges. Sometimes we won. One pub was very special, named the Barley Mow. It was just half a mile from the airfield. A lovely old place, and mentioned in the well-known book, Three Men in a Boat. It was, actually. The warden was a member of the Filford Heath Golf Club, most upmarket, and I played there at least once a week. After a round of golf, a splendid pub called the Dog House was a venue for an hour or so. I think that's about it, really.
One thing you've touched upon briefly there is the peacetime atmosphere. What was, I mean, in terms of you and our work with regular naval officers, I mean, you were no longer in the volunteer reserve.
No, that's so right.
What about that and the change of the way that is an experience of being in the
service? Well, we were all much the same, really, you know.
It wasn't more high-bound, it wasn't more...
No, not at all. Cullum, you see... I was my own boss at Cullum. We were five test pilots to begin with, and after 18 months, I was the, or 15 months, I was the only one left. So, I mean, I was my own boss as the youngest lieutenant, which was great. And I used to plan my own day completely. I would arrive at the office, I would ring up the four or five different sites to find out what was going on, and then decide what I was going to do. And I would say to the engineers, well, look, I will be at your site at a certain time and be here and so-and-so. Up for lunch, and then back again in the afternoon, and same thing happened the next day. And if the weather was too bad, well, that was it.
I mean, a pilot's dream, really, because you had this choice of aircraft to fly.
I mean, as a young lieutenant, I mean, I planned my own day and work, and it was ideal, absolutely splendid. Nice place, you know, lovely.
And good pay. I mean, you were being paid well now.
Oh, I mean, we had flying pay, even in those days, was quite a lot more on the, something like 25% more than any other lieutenant's got. Oh, yes, we had plenty of time for unlimited beer and all that sort of thing. We wanted to do, really.
Great. OK, so we've come to the end of that. So we're now at the end of 48. What happens next?
I then went to, as commanding officer of a ferry flight up at Naval Air Station Enthorn, which was near Carlisle up in Cumberland. And I did 2 years there as CEO of the squadron. Of the ferry flight. No, 12 pilots. We were controlled by a setup called RARA, which stands for Rear Admiral Reserve Aircraft. They were at the Naval Air Station. Now, both I or one of my second in command would rig up them every morning and find out what airplanes had to be ferried about in our area, which covered all the north of England and all of Scotland. And then I would decide which pilots would go to what stations to do what. We had a Dominey, a twin-engined aircraft, six-seater, seven-seaters, which would fly around and dock pilots. I sometimes did it myself, around to go on their various duties. And then they'd all do what they had to do and would be arranged to come back either, but usually by air, but sometimes they'd have to do overnight train. We could be going down to Leon Solent or even down to Coldrose or all over the country.
And abroad or not?
Not even to... Hardly ever to Northern Ireland, even, no. We did occasionally to Northern Ireland, but not much, no.
And what kind of aircraft would be?
Well, the whole...
You were flying pilots rather than aircraft, or...?
We were flying aeroplanes around about. The only time we would ferry pilots would be if they had to be brought from where they'd left an aeroplane or taken somewhere to go and fetch one.
So you flew, then, the whole gamut of...
Well, I did, because, I mean, I qualified on dual control, you see, and obviously all the pilots weren't dual controlled. And if they weren't qualified on type, well, then we used to have to get them qualified, which usually meant just one flight, maybe two at the most, usually one. They'd be briefed. In fact, those days, I recall, now you would be sitting in the aircraft and be briefed by somebody, and then off you went, and that was it. But all single aircraft are much the same, single engine, much the same, really. They've all got a throttle and a control column and rudder pedals.
But you were flying... twin engines as well, you said.
Oh, well, I was, but I mean, there'd only be about three of us in the squadron would be able to fly twins, you see. Then there weren't all that number of twins in the Navy, you remember, in those days. Really, only the Oxfords, and occasionally the RAF Anson would have to be taken somewhere on RAF Oxford, or the Dominies themselves. The Sea Hornets didn't come in until later on.
And again, was there any incident that sort of strict? I mean, now we're sort of in that period between 48 and 50.
We lost a chap called Lieutenant Green, who was an engineer pilot in a Barracuda 5, Barracuda was basically a disaster, that naval airplane. It was a torpedo bomber succeeding the Swordfish, but it was an utter disaster.
In what respect?
Well, it's just no good, really. It ended up as an anti-submarine aircraft.
No good because it flew badly? Or?
It was just too slow. I mean, the Grumman Avenger, the American torpedo bomb, was a vastly superior aircraft. It was just plain no good. That's all there was to it, the Barracuda. It had a dreadful reputation. The Barracuda 2 in particular had.
For doing what?
Well, just for being a thoroughly nasty, nasty, unpleasant airplane. Difficult to fly. A lot of nasty vices. And it was just no good for the job. But...
And you lost this man.
Well, anyway, something happened, and the... I was away. I was in London, actually, having delivered an aircraft down south somewhere, and I was catching the night train back. And I came back with a young... Well, with a middle-aged couple. They were older than I, about 40 each, I suppose. In the first class, we used to travel, obviously, as officers, warrants. And Lieutenant Green, his dinghy had inflated from the fuselage of his Barracuda and folded around the rudders. And only about 1,000 feet when it happened, the rudders elevated, and he just crashed and was killed. Nice bloke. And it turned out that when we got to Carlisle Station, we were met by a Utilicon, at least these two were met by a car, which I thought had been unusual, and were whisked away. And a tilly driver met me then, and I said, "What's going on?" And he said, "Oh, Lieutenant Green was killed yesterday." And it turned out these two I'd been travelling all the way up with my Mavis and everything. I saw them looking at me. Were his parents, yeah.
God, how terrible.
Mm. I went to his funerals down in Surrey, actually, yeah. Yeah, it was really sad that...
Caused by the
whole dinghy just inflated out and folded around the whole of the controls on the back of the airplane. Could have been me. I mean, I could have been flying quite easily myself.
Anything else that strikes you that you remember from that period?
I don't think so. There were so many different things. I remember, well, a silly little thing. Once I fly a Firefly back from Lee to somewhere or another, and the engine suddenly stopped somewhere over Gloucester way, I think. Luckily, I realised immediately what had happened, that I'd forgotten to switch over from the drop tank. You normally would take off on drop tanks, and when they were getting a bit low, you'd go onto your main tank. I'd forgotten to switch over, but I switched over straight away, and it went off with a tremendous roar again, but all was well.
All right, we're romping through this, but let's go on then to the end of... So we're now 1950-51.
Yeah, I don't think there's much... You can go on for ferry flights for hours, or you can do it in 5 minutes,
exactly.
You see it.
So I think for the purposes of this, I mean, we'll leave it there. Let's go on to... you stop flying now, don't you?
Before we go on, I will just get... And then I will read out what it says on the beginning of this next bit, and that will introduce us to what...
Okay, I've got to unplug you.
Oh, yes, gosh, yes.
There we go.
That could be a disaster, wouldn't it?
Time before. Okay.
I will start then. I see from my pilot's flying logbook that I first flew the Blackburn Firebrand on 7th of September 1949. At that time, I was CEO of an RN ferry flight based at RN Air Station Anthorne near Carlisle. It should be stated that the Firebrand had a truly appalling reputation as a thoroughly unpleasant aeroplane, being difficult, dangerous and hard work. Had I not been the CEO and honour being at stake, I very much doubt if I would have agreed to familiarise myself with it. At that time, little did I know that within 4 months, I was to spend 2 happy years, from January 1950 to December 1951, as a member of number 813 Naval Air Squadron, brackets, a frontline Firebrand squadron, and to complete some 150 deck landings with the Firebrand.
I see. Okay, well...
So that's the introduction to it. Now, I think it'd be fair to say that I was in a reasonable position to assess the qualities of the Firebrand, having...
What was the Firebrand?
It was a torpedo bomber, the development from the Swordfish. It was a big, single-engined, by a monoplane, a big aeroplane it was. My last 2 years had been spent flying Swordfish in the North Atlantic, followed by a 2-year stint as a maintenance test pilot.
Hold on, I'm just going to...
Right.